Right, today is the Thursday, the 6th of October, 2022. This is John Marriott and
Anne Hinckley
interviewing for the Dialect and Heritage Project. Can I ask you to introduce yourself, please, Frank?
I'm Frank Joel, and I farm at Westhouse in Yorkshire, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about my life and when I was born and through to the present day when I'm now 78 year old. I was born between Ingleton and Bentham at a little farmhouse. My mother had me at home, a little place called Langbour End, which my dad had rented off a chap to farm it on his own. And we stayed there for 2 years, and my dad had to give up the tenancy of the farm because the landlord's son was coming out of the army and he wanted to come back to the farm. So we moved into a little bungalow in Ingleton, and my dad lived there, and he did a bit of car dealing for a couple of years, and he also bought a tractor, a little grey Fergie petrol tractor, and a mowing machine, a little grey Fergie mowing machine, and in summer he went mowing, and he also had a sweep for the front of the tractor, and he swept hay for different people round about Ingleton. And when I was 4 years old, my dad bought Westhouse Lodge. He borrowed most of the money from the agricultural mortgage, and he had an uncle that lent him some money as well, and he managed to buy Westhouse Lodge, and we moved here in 1949 when I was just coming up 5 year old, and we moved here in the spring of 49, I think it was May, and so I had a few months at home before I started school at the village school at Westhouse, and I started there in the September. My dad had a lad worked for him from up the village, and I know me and my younger brother used to go with him before I started school. He used to leave this tractor running, and we used to run round and switch it up, and he used to play pot with us, and we scarpered off, but we sneaked back and switched it off again many and many a time, and he got really annoyed, but never really told us off so much. I think he thought it was just as much fun as we did. And I started school at Westhouse up here the same day as two other lads that I still know. One's Brian Ramwell, who joined a shop up the village, and the others, Francis Smith, and they have a little farm at Maisongill, and they do quite a bit of contracting now, him and his son. And we all three of us started school the same day. And I can remember I come home for my dinners for a few months anyway. I can't just remember how long, but I remember the first day we come out to come home and for our dinner, and Brian Ramwell was coming home for his dinner as well, and we stopped out on the road playing marbles, and this school teacher come out, and she was a bit of a madam, she, you know, could fairly straighten you up at times, and I remember we come out, and she come out and caught us playing marbles, but I was the right side of her, I could leg it, so I legged it home down to Leah and school, but Brian couldn't get past her, so he scrambled up this wall, and it was 6 foot high like this, and only a little lad, 5 year old, he scrambled up wall and run off across field to his farm. And so anyway, we got told off, and we got back to school after we've had our dinner. So that's one of the things I remember about the only thing I really remember of my school life at Westhouse, because then we're 11 plus, and brainy ones went to Kirby Grammar School, and others went to secondary modern school at Ingleton. And I went to secondary modern school in Ingleton. I were absolutely useless at English and such like, but I was one at top of class with maths, but I could always add up, and everybody said, oh, well, you'll never take any harm, you'll always be able to reckon up how much you've earned or how much you're going to want and need, and it's always been the same. I can reckon anything up in my head even today. I went to Ingleton Secondary Modern School, and I was always in the A stream. There was A, B and C, and I went through my school life always in the A stream. Whether that was just a bit of good luck and good management, I don't know, but I was never, and I were never in above the top half anyway. And I left school in 1959, and the only thing I wanted to do was come home and work with my dad. And I left school in the July, end of July, and I got yellow jaundice, and I wasn't fit to work for a month. I just was useless, and the only thing I did would never show on a cow or anything anywhere at local shows, and I learnt two cows to lead to take to Bentham Show, and we took them to Bentham Show the first Saturday in September. The show was always, and it was down on the bottom in Bentham on what's now the football field, which was a really good show ground. It was a flat field and everything was accessible. And I were a bit disappointed. We went out and we got second prize in the class, and my dad said, don't worry about it. He says, we can take it out for championship. Anyway, we took it out for championship and ended up getting reserve champion. And the cow that had beat us only just stood sixth, because it were a different judge. And so we had quite a good day, the first time we'd ever shown. Anyway, I left school. I'd started working at home after that, and enjoyed me south and played football and what have you, anyway, we worked at home, and we had different married men. Would a married man before I left school, and would a married man when I left school. But anyway, he was a good worker, and he was very, very good at building. And he put wood bullpens up, and were dipping tub and all modern sheet pens then. They maybe aren't as modern now, but they're still there, and we still use them. And anyway, he decided he wanted to go building, so he left. And so there were just me and my dad for a while, and he did employ another lad for a few months. Then my next brother left school and he worked at home. So there was three of us, me and my brother and my dad, for quite a number of years. And then I met John, and it was sort of a blind date, as you might have it. A friend arranged it for us, and so it all happened. And I don't know what we did really, but we were sat in the car, and I can remember we had the radio on, and they announced that President Kennedy had been assassinated. That was our first date, was that particular day when President Kennedy was assassinated. And so we courted for 2 years or a bit more, and were married in 1965. John was my best man, and he'd worked down at Low Three, but just a few 100 yards from where we lived, and we were big pals at the time, and we still are. And John's sister was a bridesmaid, and my cousin Wendy, which was Wendy Bentham, she passed away just recently, and another lass called Sylvia Jackson were the three bridesmaids, and my youngest brother, he's 14 years younger than me, and he was only 6, and he was a little page boy. We got married at Arcombe Methodist Chapel, and we didn't know where we were going to go for honeymoon. We were a bit undecided, and anyway, I said to a day or two before, I said, well, listen to weather forecast, see where it's going to be fine before we decide. Anyway, we were going to go to Scotland, but it was going to rain in Scotland, so we ended up going to Wales. And we stayed. We thought we'd get bed and breakfast, so we were going down this street into, I forget where it was now, Rill, I think. I think it was going down, it wasn't as built up them days in 65, like there'd been a lot of houses built since then. And we saw this bed and breakfast place, and so we went and knocked on the door, could we have bed and breakfast? And we got bed and breakfast, and it was, I think it was 15 shillings a night, was bed and breakfast. So we stayed there for a week and had a bed and breakfast, and we got on really well. I forget what they called, Joan, I'd remember what they call. They called the name of the woman that had it. And we had a lovely time in Rill, and we went off for days and did and saw. And I think we went to pictures one night, and I think we saw Beatles in the first picture they made, but I can't be 100% sure about that, but I think we did. But and anyway, that's where we went for honeymoon, and we come back, and we lived next door to my dad down at the farmhouse, which there was a cottage as well, and we lived there. We didn't actually move in there when we were first married. We stayed with my mother and dad for a couple of months, because with one or two bits of alterations we wanted to do. There was no kitchen, not a proper kitchen units in, and we put them in, and there wasn't an inside toilet. You had to go outside and up a big flight of stairs to go to the toilet, so we weren't having that. So we managed to make a bedroom, take a bit of a bedroom and make a bathroom upstairs. And so we did that before we got moved in. And so we lived down there for, 1965 we were married, so we've lived down there for 35 years in the same house. And anyway, we have to move on a little bit now, because then Terry and Andrea were born, my son and my daughter. Terry come along in the 15th of January 1968, and then Andrea come along on the 9th of December 1968, so there's only sort of 11 months between them. And John had a bit of bother with them, so, you know, to fetch them up, and she had Terry at Lancaster Hospital, and she had Andrea at home. Andrea were a little bit of a awkward one to bring up. She used to fetch all the food back, and then she'd have a little bit, and she were like a sparrow, wasn't she? But anyway, she managed, once she got onto solid food, she went on like a house on fire. So, and now then, where I've got to, they come along, so we had our hands full, really. Joan had her hands full. I was working most of the time, she. So anyway, my mother and dad were next door, so my mother gave her quite a lot of help. Kids used to run round there every night when Joan used to come out and give me a hand on farm, and they went round there. Then I don't know how old our kids were. They were maybe 7 or 8, and my mother died very suddenly. And so that was a bit of a blow, but you have to carry on. And then A few years passed by and my dad decided he wanted to retire, and I was only 28, and my dad decided he would retire, and so I took over and rented the farm from him and bought the stock and borrowed the money, and it was a bit of a struggle because interest rate were then 18%, which you nearly unheard of today when it's been struggling like at about 0.5%. I know it's on its way up at the moment, but it was a struggle at 18%. And I know we bank manager come to us one day, he said, "You can't afford to pay your money off." He said, "I'm just going to put you on interest only for a couple of years till you get on your feet." And I'll always remember him coming, and we were really relieved that he'd done that for us. And anyway, we managed and we've got through it and we're here. And anyway, we managed, and anyway, my dad found another lady and got married again, and he sold the house next door to where we were and he went to live with her in Ingleton. So that we were totally on our own then. My dad was giving me a little bit of a hand night and morning, you know, feeding cows and helping and feeding dogs and cats and all this, and all them little jobs seemed to be all for us to do at that time. And we had two lads used to come and work for us 2 days a week each. Jimmy was one of them and Tony the other one, which we were friends with Jimmy for a lot of years, and we were friends with Tony and his wife Carol and still are. And anyway, then as time went on, Terry left school and he worked at home with us for quite a number of years, and we altered with a shipment that held 44 cows tied up bit neck, and we altered them, which that shipment when it was put up was like a big one, but it because my dad put it up in 1949. I can remember that the first day we sent 200 gallon of milk, which was a lot of milk in them days, from 44 cows, because they didn't milk like Holsteins do today. And anyway, then we decided we wanted to milk more sows, so we pulled all the bostings and everything out of the shipment and made it into cubicles for 60, and put a parlour in the old stone barn and put silo pits up and a feed area, and we milked 60 cows for quite a lot of years. And anyway, we managed to I've forgotten what I'm going to say now. We made all our own silo with, and we shared silo tackle with Tony Blair. And we used to take it in turns. They went first, alternate years. And we must have done that for 10 to 15 years. And then we decided that we were going to need another new set of buildings. And anyway, Terry wasn't that keen on milking. I was still doing all the milking. Terry wasn't that keen on milking, and so we decided we'd come out of milk and would go into star cattle and more sheep, and which we did. And then we carried on like that, and I'd sort of set up my mind that I was going to retire when I was 60, but it didn't happen. And Terry didn't seem to want to take over for some reason or another. And anyway, he decided he wanted to go building. So he went off building, and I sort of carried on, but I let some of my land off and farmed the rest and carried on. And then my grandson Jack decided that he might want to farm, so we sort of carried on, and we've he's sort of helping me. Well, I'm helping him now, not him helping me. I'm helping him now. And so he thinks he's boss, but I still think I'm boss as well. So it's, we have a little bit of friction sometimes, but we seem to get it all sorted out one way or another. And just recently we've just put a little caravan site in, because we thought that the single farm payment money was going to dwindle away to nothing, and we'd have to have another form of income. So we've just put a little caravan site in for five, and it's been quite successful, and we've had a lot of good reports about it and all this and all that. And here we are today, and I'm 78 and I'm still working, but I enjoy it anyway. So I think that's about what I've got to tell you.
Can I tell you, when your dad, because it can't have been easy for your dad starting up a new, you know, when he moved to Westhouse and he set up a new farm, and just sort of interested to know, over the years, sort of what the farming enterprise was like then, you know, sort of breeds and numbers, and how it's changed, you know, how you've seen it change over the years into the sheep and the breeds of animals that have changed. And
right.
The farm is
changed. Yeah, well, the first year my dad came here, like, there was no building, no new buildings up at all. It was just an old farmstead down where the farmhouse is now. And there was a shipping for eight, and a converted stable for six, and then a shipping for four, and a shipping for nine, and another shipping for five. But it all had a milk pipeline in, and he milked 34 cows down there the first winter we were down there. And then he borrowed money again to put a shipping up for 44 with Provin House and dairy and so you could back tractor down middle, tractor and spreader down middle at shipping, and put muck into spreader, and we used to take it every day. And that's how that's progressed from there. I mean, he didn't lamb any sheep when we first started, and we didn't lamb any sheep till I left school. And he used to just take wintering hogs in for winter, and he used to buy sheep with lambs at foot in the spring. And then they were all sold and start again. You know, we hogs and lambs at foot in the spring. And then I left school and I wanted to lamb some sheep. So we still took wintering hogs in, but we lambed 40 sheep the first winter. But he said, if you were lambing sheep, you were looking after them, and that was it. So I looked after them. But, and that's where my interest of sheep would really start, would be when I persuaded my dad to lamb 40 sheep. And we progressed from there, and we ended up most probably lambing 100 to 150 and not take any hogs on at all. So, and the breed of sheep when we first started was most probably Mashams, put to the Suffolk Tup. And then mules appeared, and I can remember us going up to Penrith to buy some mules, and next door neighbours, John Lawson's, went with us. And I know we bought 28, and they bought six or eight, which they all come back in the same wagon. And I can remember as we bought these 28 mules, and that was out my first experience of mules. And I've always I've always been mule mad, and I've judged at quite a number of shows with mule classes. And now we keep hardly any mules. We lamb nearly nothing but Texel crosses or Texel Beltex crosses to try and produce these better quality lambs. We do have sort of a, what we call a pure flock, which is like they've all been bred from Texel ewes and crossed with Beltex tup, and they're like half and half ewes, which are very good confirmation. And we have a sale at Skipton. We take it to a sale at Skipton in December, and we sell 60 to 70 individuals Texel cross mules, you know, anywhere from shearings to 3 shears, and we try to select the best that we can afford to let go, because we have to keep some of the best, or else we wouldn't have a best. So that's how our sheep have progressed over the years. And the dairy cows, well, my dad milked all sorts when we first started, like just what he could afford, you know, like cows were only maybe about 50 to 70 pound a head then, but it was still a lot of money. And I can remember when we bought our first baler in 1959, year I left school, and we bought a Massey tractor, a red Massey four-cylinder tractor, and my dad had sold 30 new calf cows that autumn to average £100 a piece, which was like good for the time, you know, that era. Pardon me. And he decided we were going to have we'd had a good day with these cows. We could afford to buy a tractor and a baler. And I can remember the baler cost, it was £529 was the baler, Massey 703 it was. And my dad bid Gibson's, he said, "I'll give you 500. And Gibson's man said, "It'll have to be 529, but I'll let you have £29 worth of string to bail it with." And that was the deal for the... And anyway, I think we bought the Fergie tractor off Ainsworth's at Ingleton. And Eric Middleton had been the mechanic there. He's just died recently, is Eric? And he did all our tractor repairs. After we got that first tractor, we got quite a number of tractors from him, and we got this four-cylinder Massey 35 from him, and that's our machines. And that baler, we had it 11 years, I think, and we traded that in 1970, we traded it in. And we got a Massey Fergie 20, and I still have it, but it's never been used for, it's inside, never been outside, it never ever been left out in rain, even when we come back in airtime, even if it were looking like being fine, it were always put in, and we've never ever left it out in rain. I still have it in a shed, and I keep saying I'm going to get it out and try and do it up and get it going again, but never seem to find time. And then machinery-wise, I mean, we moved on to siloing, and we got contractors for a number of years, and then we got fed up of having to wait and wait with turn, and weather wasn't just how we wanted it to be for getting with silos. So we decided, and we got together with Tony, bought our own forager and a trailer apiece and a mower between us, and we started doing it together, and we bought a second-hand forager, which was a side-mounted JF, and then we had two or three new side-mounted JFs, and then we progressed a bit further, and we got a trail forager, which was the one we used last, and then once we went out of milk, we went on to big bales, so the forager was sold, and partnership sharing job disappeared, so that was the end of that.
I'm interested in sort of pre-tractor, you know, sort of the haymaking and siloing, for how it changed over your period of working from before tractors. What are your memories of then?
Oh, well, I can remember as well. I mean, it was all, if it was going to rain, it was all cocked up and we'd check it out next morning with forks, and sometimes we'd have a sort of a tether thing that had bash it out a bit. We'd go through it once with tether thing, then we'd all go through it with forks and check it all out again. And if it was turning, it was, we had a turning machine, what they called a dicky turner, and it used to, the butt end where the mower had left the butt end of the grass so that you could see, it used to get hold of it, did this spinner and turn it over. And I mean, they were quite successful, but they were fairly slow. But then if you really wanted to get it dry, it was turn it after you'd shaken it out, turn it with hand, and there'd be five or six of you, and me included, when I were a little lad, had a rake that had a short shaft on, and I used to be six of you'd go across the corner and rake a little strip about 2 foot wide and turn it over into little sort of rolls, and then you'd leave it like that for a while, and then you'd set to and go through it again with scaling machine and scale it and do. And when we first made hay, we'd row it up into a big plat, which would be 2 foot 6 high and 2 foot 6 wide, and then you'd either drive between the plats and fork it onto trailer and cart it back to barn and throw it off, or you'd sweep it to barn door with tractor and sweep. But it was still to drag inside and fork onto mow and do, and it was quite a labour intensive system. And all the hay in the barn, then it was all to drag out and big armfuls and go. Like, we were fortunate when my dad put the new sheep and looked like it had a fodder gang up either side, and you dragged your handfuls here up the side, then dropped it over into the front of the booses for the cow seat, and it was rather labour intensified, really. But you know, everything progressed. The machines they use today are like modern compared to what was right up into the, you know, like into the 90s. We only had like a hay bob or a, and we thought there were bees and these were hay bobs, but now like they're hardly ever used. I mean, we still have one, but we didn't use it this year at all. We Jack working for a contractor a bit. He comes with those big machines and you can have it done in no time at all, like, really.
And what about the type, so in the areas as a whole, and so the Yorkshire Dales and around here, how have you seen the type of farming, you know, the size of farms, how have you seen that change over the years from when your dad first started?
Well, when we first started here, like, every farm sold milk. Every farm put milk kits onto the stand every day. And I mean, in West House alone, there'd be 10 to 12 farms producing milk, you know. Maybe, I mean, we used to send, I can remember the most we ever sent was about 200 gallon in kits. Well, kits varied. They set off as 12 galloners, then they went down to 10 galloners. And I can remember I can't remember the exact day when we sent 200 gallon, but it was a lot of milk was 200 gallon a day. But I do remember in 1968, Foot and Mouth, and we couldn't sell any cows, and we ended up milking 50. We made a few cubicles in a shed, and we put 5 in there, and we swapped them into the ship night and morning to milk, and we milked 50, and we sent 250 gallon a day for quite a number of months that winter in 1968. and we're lifting 25 keats of milk onto a milk stand every morning. Well, milk stand were full and there were nowhere to put keats. He used to just throw them off into the yard and we had to gather them up. When milk wagon had gone. And the following year, we went on to bulk, 1969. We went on to bulk, but we just missed out. The year before, we put a 250 gallon bulk tank in then, and we filled it many a time after that. But every farm in Westhouse sent milk, and they all disappeared, and there isn't one left at all now. Lunds at Lundown would be the last in Westhouse to go out of milk.
And you mentioned Footmouth in 67, 68, and then obviously 2001.
Yeah.
What are your memories of that difference, you know, any contrast between the 60s and then, and also the effect that it had on this community, the farming community and the tourist community?
I think in 67 and 68, I mean, we had restrictions on, we couldn't sell anything. But as soon as everything got clear, within a few weeks or a few months anyway, the restrictions were all lifted and we were all back to normal. And I mean, I do know that, like, we'd cows everywhere. And we'd sum up at Out Barn and they were running in and out at Out Barn, and it was, you know, we were just mowed out with them. But as soon as it were over, there were people scrambling for cows because of all them that had been taken with foot and mouth. And I mean, we'd no trouble selling them. I mean, some were sold at a lot more than they were ever worth because they were that desperate for them. And that was 68. I mean, job were all over in a month or two. Every restriction were lifted. And now, after 2020, we're still restricted. We've still all licences for sheep and licences for this and licences for that. And I just don't see the need for these licences, to be quite truthful, because it's disappeared. And years before, it was all over in a few months, and now it's still dragging on, and we're still having to all this blooming paperwork for, which I don't know whether it's really necessary.
And because this area is a sort of a mixture of farming and tourism, really, isn't it? And I suppose probably more tourism now than there used to be back in those days. And I suppose that the mood of this area at the time of Foot and Mouth as to how, you know, how it was in the farming community, how it was with the tourist, you know.
I mean, the thing is, I mean, I haven't had a lot to do with tourism because we've never really, you know, we have, as a farm, we've never gone into it. We've never had a bed and breakfast place and never had caravans until recently. I mean, it would affect especially bed and breakfast places, I should have thought, because people, they didn't want people moving about from area to area, like spreading this foot and mouth. I mean, there was quite a lot of rumours went round in 2000 that it was spread on purpose, but that's might be only a wife's tale, I don't know. But I mean, I do know a lot of farmers that had foot and mouth come out a lot better off than them that didn't. You know, but it was whether, you know, some fairly wished they had been taken out, but it wasn't so in my case, because there were, my, you know, cows and your herd of cows was your pride and joy. And it was the last thing you'd want was to see them all shot and disposed of. But, you know, financially, we were most probably worse off than those that actually got it. Because, like, you know, if you look around, the people that had it seem to have gone like on like houses of fire since they had foot and mouth. But that might be just me talking.
So getting back to early life, well, partly your parents, you know, your memories of any traditions they might have passed on to you, and also, I mean, you talked about sort of games when you were children, as to any memories of the things you used to, you know, do, and spending your time outside and what you used to do then. I know you mentioned about switching the tractor off and stuff.
Switching the tractor off. Okay.
But any sort of, and I know you were into your football as well, so just interested to hear about, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, my dad never wanted me to play football, as you know, like join a club like Ingleton or any, which I would have loved to have done, like, but. In summer, there was a lot of what they call six-a-side football competitions, which was designed really for farmers that couldn't have time off from the farm to play on a Saturday. And we used to have a team from round here, and we used to enter three or four competitions, try and win these six-a-sides. We were quite successful. I don't think we ever won a right lot, but we really enjoyed it. And I did when my dad retired and I was 28, I did play a little bit for Ingleton and a little bit for Burton in Lonsdale, but it got nearly impossible because you were having to rush back to try and milk on a Saturday afternoon, which wasn't right. It wasn't right good, really. My dad and mother, we never had a television. And we never got a television until we got married. And then we bought a second-hand television for 10 quid. and it was only a black and white, was that then. But my dad and mother would never have a television at all. Like it was play drafts or whatever. Drafts mostly, because my dad were good at drafts. I could never beat my dad at drafts. And our Terry's very good at drafts. I can't beat him now, so I've been a loser all my life at drafts.
And what about traditions in the family? You know, sort of, I suppose, Christmas or other times of the year, any special traditions that you remember?
Well, my dad was a big Methodist. Methodist chapel was a big part of his life. It was part of our lives when we were kids as well, because we always had to go to chapel and we had to go to Sunday school and that dominated my dad's life to a big extent, did his chapel life. We were brought up to go to chapel, and we did go to chapel for quite a lot of years. It's a thing that we're brought up with, and it's like I still believe that there is a place for Christianity in people's lives, and yeah, some people say it's all a myth, but a lot of people believe it isn't. I think in the older generation there was more, you were either chapel or you were church, and there wasn't a lot of in between, I don't think. But I think now it is sort of nearer together than it'll ever been.
And what about, because obviously you're in an ideal position to see nature and spending most of your time outside. And have you seen any, well, the sort of the changes in the countryside and wildlife from a childhood to now?
Well, wildlife, you see, when we were brought up as kids, like, ration books were still in force until mid-1950s. So, like, food was scarce. Food was basic as well, which, nothing wrong with that, as long as you had plenty of it. And, like, such as wildlife, like, we had a railway track run through our land, and there was forever a rabbits on the railway line. And my daddy used to set snares, and we used to catch rabbits with snares. And my mother used to make rabbit pie, and would have rabbit pie once a week, if not twice a week. And it was something we really enjoyed, all of us. Then mixing with horses come, and like, your rabbits disappeared, and everybody, well, didn't want to eat rabbit because they didn't want them, you know, this. Ate a rabbit that was infected with mixed mortortis, but it was shameful to see what they suffered, really, rabbits with mixed mortortis, you know. Many a time you've done one in many a time because they've had mixie. And like, and such as now, there's nowhere near as many as there used to be. I mean, they still are about, and there's still sometimes we get an odd lad or two out of Lancaster that's been coming for years, come and have a walk round with a gun, and they sometimes get one and they get two. Some of them come with a ferret or two and try to bolt them out, but there isn't many as there were, and I don't think there's as many starlings as there was. I mean, when we were kids, shipping and inside shipping used to be full of starlings. Now, whether they've been, they said a lot of birds disappeared with de Eldrin dip for dipping sheep. A lot of the small birds. Now, whether that was true or not, but there doesn't seem to be as many starlings as there was when I was a kiddie. Other wildlife, well, we see park foxes coming down here. We have an odd set or two that they come down and have the young ones in occasionally, but usually we have a chap up village comes and disposes of them somehow. We haven't any badgers as we know of, which we're thankful for, really, because a lot of these, you know, these people in Wales, and they've lost a lot of cattle to badgers and TB.
You saw a dead one on the road on the way up here, actually. And what about your ancestry, your grandparents, and sort of interested, you know, because obviously your dad was from here. Do you know whether there was any move, you know?
Yeah, well, my dad come from Milham originally, and he was 18 year old when he come down into this area, and they moved to a little farm called Overregill. It's where the Robinson and Mitchell have the knacker yard now. That was where my dad come to when he was 18, and my uncle Bill would come, Billy Joel from Brookhouse at Bentham, he would come with him, but he was 2 year older, and he would be carting when they come down, and he married a lady from Milham, and my dad met my mother, was her dad was a miner, and he come from somewhere up Durham way somewhere to be, I think, one of the boss men at Ingleton Colliery, or a better sort of a job he had anyway, Ingleton Colliery, and they lived in Ingleton, and that's where my mother and dad come from. But my grandparents farmed at Milham, and my grandmother had a stall on Barrow Market, and they used to sell the produce from the farm, like eggs, rabbits, we've just been speaking about, and butter and cheese and eggs, anything that they could sell on this stall in Barrow Market. And my granddad used to take them and put him on to put her on train at Millen to take to go to Barrow Market. And my dad used to say, and he said he can remember. My dad can remember him. There was going to be an auction, the auction at Barrow, and he took these two Chardon bull calves, and they got to 7 and 6 pence or something, and he wanted 10 shilling for them. And so he fetched them all the way back, and he kept them all winter, and took them back again, and made 12 and 6 pence of them. He had two and sixpence for wintering them all winter. Which is a bit, you know, like, we wouldn't do it today. Hopefully we wouldn't do it today anyway.
Sometimes you made your mind up about something, haven't you?
Yeah.
You mentioned the colliery. I hadn't realised there was a colliery in Ingleton, actually, but I'm just interested in, you know, any memories of that, and also how you think the work situation's changed. I mean, I know it's sort of a lot of agriculture.
In Ingleton, you see, the new village would be built for the colliery workers. That, you know, there's an inner circle and an outer circle around the new village. I don't know how many houses there'll be, what, 100. And they were all built for colliery workers. And the pit yard was somewhere where Brian Hook is, where his scrap yard is, it's called the pit yard, is Brian Hook's. And it used to, there's still workings go way out towards Bentham, and there's a little place called the Winnings, and they reckon there's a shaft somewhere about there, about the Winnings, but there's very, very little you can see. There is a little bit of a monument where Main Road comes down and the road forks down into Ingleton. There's a little triangle there, and there is something there built as a memory at Coal Yard, but I couldn't tell you just what it is. I've been past it many a time, but I couldn't just tell you what it is. But that is where, that is just there, where Brian Hook is. And after that, there was a transport cafe built there, like a day and night transport cafe, when wagons used to stop and all sorts of things used to stop. Because they reckon that there was Silent Night used to come there, and there was one or two spare beds got taken off back of these wagons. And they got distributed in Ingleton. And one fella had got one of these beds in Ingleton, and then carol singers went round and sang Silent Night outside his outside his front door. Could he come out and chest them off? It might be just a tale, that, I don't know, but it was what was going round at the time anyway.
It's a good one. Any memories of games, you know, sort of as a child, any games you used to play, you know, or anything that might have been local to this area, or were you busy working on the farm?
I mean, when we were kiddies, we used to go up the village, and there was a little village green where the road parks up the village, and, you know, quite a triangle of grass, and we used to play tin can of lurkey, it was called, and we'd put a tin on, and somebody were on, and we had to kick tin, and them that were on had to wait there with their eyes shut, and kick tin, and he had to go and get tin, and he had to find one of us, and tiggers, and we had to go back, put it on thing, and kick it, and it was called tin can of lurkey with that. And there'd be 8 or 10 of us, and there'd be nearly all lads, but there were hardly any girls in the village, but there were nearly all lads. And that's what we used to play when we were 13 or 14. Up to 16, maybe. When we don't know better to do, I think. But it was, you know, we're all around Ramwell's buildings, and we're all into yard and into barn and hiding everywhere. And that was one of the main games we played.
What about socially? You know, when you, as you... as you got a bit older, what you know, dances or things that went on sort of locally?
Yeah, well, locally we've been brought up with as a Methodist. We very, very rarely went to dances, and we weren't allowed to go to dances. We'll put it that smart, you know. So it was sort of social. They used to have socials where they played games and all this, and that's when we went mostly, weren't it? There'd be two or three a week, more in winter than in summer. And then with summer game, we're taking up with this six-a-side football, mostly, and working, getting crops in. Was one of priorities, you know, you'd to be open about doing that. And but the six-a-side football used to take most of summer up anyway.
And the children that you were at school with, sort of primary school and from the village, what did they do on the whole? Did many people move away, or did people tend to get jobs locally, or were they all farming?
A lot of people that I went to school with, you know, like the schools weren't as big as they are now, because like obviously we've a bigger population than we had when we were going to school. I mean, school at Ingleton would only be there'd be 13, 8, 9, maybe 250 to 300 kids, but there'd be four different age groups. A lot of locals come from Bentham and Ingleton. A lot went and got jobs at Angus's. Others got apprenticeships. Like, that was a big thing when we were leaving school, was getting like a electrical apprenticeship, a joiner or whatever. I mean, some of the very brainy ones, well, would get better jobs, but I mean, them that went to secondary modern school, they didn't, because, you know, they didn't really get a chance to go to university or college or anything then, because it was marked grammar school kids that got a chance to go to, you know, university.
Can you just explain what Angus's is and how big an employer it still is?
They'd employed 200 maybe more in their heyday, and they made fire hose and fire fighting equipment. They were a big employer in this area, and still are, but not maybe as, like, it's like anything else. The machines have got moderner, so they don't need as many people. You know, like, when they went there, it was more hands-on stuff they had to do. I mean, there were joiners there. Some of them got apprenticeship joiners at Angus's even. But they were, I mean, then there were, like, in Ingleton, like, there was Berlin and Mending, which was quite a lot of girls went there. But, I mean, it's been shut for...
What was that?
Berlin and Mending. It was sort of mending fabric that was maybe had a fault in it and things like that. That's I think that's what it did anyway. But that isn't there now. I mean, there wasn't really a lot of employment in Ingleton. I mean, colliery, I don't know when the colliery shut, but I mean, I can only remember my granddad on my mother's side as an old man that would be virtually retired, because I do know he used to come on and help my dad a little bit on farm. But, you know, only to do some fencing and things like that. But the colliery must have shut then, I'm pretty sure. So that must have been round about in late 1940s, early 50s, colliery must have shut.
Because in back in those days, a lot of the farm workers actually used to live on farm, didn't they? Or live, you know, live with the family. But the guys that worked for you weren't.
Well, yeah, I mean, my dad had, when I was a kid, he would have one or two lads that lived in. And he'd just have a bedroom and he'd have his meals with us, and he'd go out at night wherever he wanted to. And he'd come back in and have his bed. And but I can only remember one lad, he was called Carnthwaite. But that's the only one I can really remember, because he had a married man, you see, most of the time, and he had a local lad or two that lived in the village, but they went back home. And they just come down at, you know, 6 o'clock or 6:30, whenever they wanted. They might have come in for the breakfast and the dinners, and then might have a bit of tea, but they'd go back home to live to sleep at night. You see, my dad and mother, my mother's sister, when they got married, they lived with us, but they had a bedroom and a downstairs room with a kitchen in. But they used the same stair, and they lived with us for a few years until they eventually bought a house in the new village in Ingleton. But they did live with us for maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 years anyway. But it was just as a stopgap, really, until they got a house of their own.
We'll sort of move on to dialect sort of in a bit, but is there anything that's arisen that you want to...
Can I just check some spellings? Mm. your best man, John Aki, how do I spell the surname?
Hacking,
I didn't hear.
H-A-C-K-I-N-G.
Right. And Tony Blake, how?
B-L-A-C-O-W.
Right, sorry, right. And Milham, that's near Barrow, is it, in Cumbria?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Arkholme, am I right here? A-R-K-H-O-L-M-E.
Yes, yeah.
Thank you. Right, yeah. The only other thing is, what type of dairy cows? I don't remember you saying.
Well, yeah. Well,
sorry, breed, I beg your pardon.
Well, and how that changed as well, because you said your dad had a mixture of breeds, but and then obviously, you know, black and whites later, but how did that evolve?
We ended up getting back mostly to British Friesians, but a lot of them would be crossbred with Ayrshires. Because that was the big thing then. Ayrshire cross, first crosses with Friesian was reckoned to be the bees and knees at the time.
Whereabouts was that?
Well, round about the time I left school, or just before my dad would, before, you know, when I were 10 or 11, these Ayrshire cross ones seemed to come about, and the first cross out of an Ayrshire was most probably the best cross, and then you crossed them again to Friesian, but you didn't get that nice udder that Ayrshire had, but you tried to, obviously. This cow we showed, first time we showed, it'd be a Ayrshire crossed twice with Friesian most probably, but it had a right good udder and right good type of a cow. And then I wanted to go pedigree Friesian, and so we started in what we call grading up, and the British Friesian Society come and inspected your cows you put forward, which was obviously your best ones to try and breed up, and they called them ASRs. And then the calf out of an ASR were a BSR, the calf out of a BSR were a CSR, and the calf out of a CSR were a full pedigree. And that's how you graded up. But we did buy quite a number of pedigree Frisians at the pedigree Frisian sales at Lancaster, which they had once a month. It was a big thing, was the Frisian sales at Lancaster. Especially they had an autumn sale, especially just for heifers, new calved heifers, and then there'd be 250, you know, like after I left school in 1960s to 70s, it was a big thing, was the Frisian sales at Lancaster, especially this big sale in September, and like there were some prices that were unbelievable, really, you know. And I can remember as my dad and me going to a sale when Ernest Townley sold his pedigree Frisian herd at Nutter Farm. And Ernest Townley was a big friend of my dad's, and so my dad had to go. He had to go and buy a cow in sale. And I said, "Well, I said you'll have to step on it if you want to buy a decent cow in sale." Anyway, he'd buy it. He took a fancy to the Shire heifer, and I think it were 225 guineas. And I know Ernest Townley shouted out, "That's most you've ever given for a cow," and it was. And that I don't just know what year it was.
And how did that cow do for him?
It was so-so. Would plenty better at all, really. We ended up showing it at Bentham, but would that particular year would two better cows than that of our own. And it we won with our own cow, but it didn't go anywhere, didn't that? No, it was, I don't know, there was some, it wasn't just right of its legs, I know it wasn't. But that's how it is, you know.
So those changes in breeds were based on yield mainly?
On?
Milk yield mainly.
Well, mostly, I mean, your Frisian cows give, you know, your Frisian bred cows would give a lot more milk. Maybe not as high a quality, but you didn't really get paid for quality them days. It was volume of milk you got paid for, you know, whether it was 3.5% butter fat or it were 4% butter fat, it didn't seem to make a lot of difference. I mean, this solids job come in later on, you know, that you got paid for your better quality milk, you know, because a lot of the milk that we produced early on, it only went to bottling for people to drink and put on the cornflakes. you know, after later on it got made into butter and more milk, and there were more wanted to be made into butter and cheese, and they wanted better quality milk to make those products. And you were paid a bit more for your milk if it were better quality.
And on the sheep front, you said you went from Massams to
mules,
yeah. And what was driving that decision? And then later on to, you know, perhaps you sort of explain why, and then changing to Texels. And
I think with the mules was they produced more milk, and they most probably produced more lambs than the Masham. You know, whereas you would be getting a lamb and three quarters with your Mashams, like you get two plus with your mules, and sometimes I think you most probably got too many lambs with your mules, too many jolly triplets. I mean, I can remember when we were married, and when we took over in 28, when I were 28, we were lambing mules, and I mean, we were getting a third of them having triplets, and hardly any singles. And you didn't know what to do with pet lambs. We had Brian Lund down the road. He used to deal in pet lambs a bit, so they used to end up down there, like, and he used to just dump them on him, and then he used to straighten up with his end of lambing time, and he'd sold them all for a bit more than he'd given us for them. So which was, you know, but it were a matter of getting them out at where we didn't want pet lambs.
And any memories, you're obviously spending all your life outside, any memories of severe weather events, especially sort of around lambing time, or, you know, any events that sort of made life difficult for you?
Yeah, we've had all sorts. When we put the first sheep shed up, my brother were a joiner, and we built it virtually ourselves. And purlins went on trusses, and I said to him, I said, you're going to have to put something to fasten the purlins onto the trusses. Anyway, it didn't get done at the time, and it come that severe wind from a different direction to what we'd had wind before. It was when it blew all them trees over, just going down into Bentham, and it took the roof off some of the roof off this new sheep shed. Hadn't been up so long, and I remember. Province traveller come that morning, and he said, where's sheep shed gone? I said, it took it off that fast. I said, it went through air and lights were still on. He said, nay, they weren't still on. And I said, they were, and he sort of half believed me. and actually, it just about did that. It just, I went up to a building, and it had blown some of it off, and then our Terry was behind me somewhere, and another piece went whizzing from sheep belly over the road and into the meadow at side of road, and it wasn't far off our Terry when it went over, I'll tell you. It was a bit frightening. And there were doors off prefab where we had were young stock. And it just blew, and it blew another door off, and it sucked it onto opening. It were frightening that morning. I've never seen a wind like it, never.
And what year would that be then? How old was Terry?
Oh, I can't remember. It was when sheep building was put up, so I should say in 80s on. Late 80s.
Maybe. Famous wind.
Yes, it would be. When he said it's not. Yeah. When whoever that weatherman was denied it, didn't he? It's not going to happen.
Oh, when Fish got it wrong.
Yes.
I don't know whether it was that or not, but it could have been.
Yeah.
But he didn't do much weather forecasting after that, did he?
He was sacrificed, wasn't he? And what about snow? How do you do for snow and over the? There was a famous Easter snowfall, wasn't there?
Well, we had a snowstorm, and it filled the road from our buildings down to Burton in Lonsdale, and it was just level four with hedges, top of hedges, and we dug it out up the village with our tractor and loader to get milk tanker out. Was it milk? Would it be milk tanker, or would it be? Yeah, milk tanker. And milk tanker got to us, but it couldn't get down the lane. And I know John Taylor dug it out with a load of bucket, but he dumped out snow onto the top of hedge. And it killed quite a bit of hedge, actually, with dumping snow on top of hedge. But it was just level with wall and top of hedge nearly. But it stopped, up from our buildings back up to the main road was nothing like as bad. But we did dig it out with loader, but we had a bad storm one April. And we'd been to a village hall at Colham Bridge. And Alan Middleton from Leckfell House, they were saying, oh, we've just had our sheep in, they're as fit as fire. He says, we'll be lambing in about a week. And they hadn't left, they'd left the fell gates shut, took them back onto the fell and took the fell gates shut. And they wished they'd left the fell gates open because it come this big snow. And they lost 200 in snow. and there's a lot more that they wish had died because they, you know, they are sort of recovered, but they never recovered, if you will. They were just, you know, just trailing about, like, didn't know what to do. And they'd a right do with them.
At a time of year that you don't really...
And it was round, they didn't start lambing till sort of the middle of April. We just into April we saw him at this do, and they said, oh, we're shapering right fettle. It had been a good winter until then. And then it come this, just into April it was.
We just put ours up onto the allotment as well.
Yeah, well, we'd taken some up onto the allotment. Well, we had an allotment and we'd rented the field below, and there was a cripple all through the wall, and we'd put some singles onto the field below, and we'd open the cripple all and shoved them onto the allotment day before, and there was an odd lamb buried up there, wasn't there?
It was alive.
It was alive, was that? Yeah. And then with another April, sort of April 1st, it was a dear friend of mine got married, was that? It was April 1st, and with a storm, and with quite a lot of lambs buried, were just in one field, and with one missing. And we never did find it, and it was a single. And so we brought the sheep inside and we put another lamb on it. And me and my dad went fencing into same field Thursday after the Saturday come this storm. And this lamb come running across field and started chewing at me trousers. And it was lamb that had been buried. And it had survived from Saturday to the following Thursday. Anyway, we took it home. We'd wanted a pet lamb. It didn't take a lot of mothering on because it were hungry. We never thought we'd see that lamb alive again, but it just happened. We went into the field to do some fencing and this lamb come and it was chewing at me trousers and couldn't. It was amazing, really, with that. It was like, you'd call it a little miracle, that, really.
Is there anything else you want to talk about, or shall we get on to the... I mean, there's a bit of a chat about dialect, and then there's the test.
which isn't a test at all.
is there anything history-wise, Anne, that you...
No.
I think we've gone through a lot there. That's really good.
Yeah, yeah.
Now we're sort of moving more on to sort of language and dialect, and whether there's basically what the local dialect means to you. Any words that you can think of? I mean, you've mentioned a few actually, and I think there's quite a few farming, you know, terms that are particular to the Dales in this area. And also whether you've inherited any sayings or words from your...
Well, I mean, really speaking, like, for me, I were brought up with it, and, like, what you always, like, such as the things my dad said, I say, you know, virtually, you know, like, boskins and things like that, and weather and water and all this sort of... It's... what your parents are like, isn't it, really, most of the time. I mean, I know it is at school, but you spend more time with your parents than you do at school, really.
And do you think it's anything from your grandparents' side, from coming a bit further up north? Was there any phrases that they used that you think were peculiar to that, to the Cumbria?
We didn't see that much of our grandparents, to be quite truthful. Even though they were local, I mean, especially when we were at school, we hardly ever saw my dad's parents. I mean, they lived at Raygill, but that seemed far enough away when we were kids. And my dad used to visit them on a Wednesday when he'd come back from Bentham, from market, and And then he used to go over Saturday and visit them. Because I can remember him going, one day and he'd just got a fresh car. He'd got a Rover 90, which was Beasney's at the time. And he'd got to the other side of Ingleton, and there's just a little rise up on the top of a hill. And he missed getting up. It was the most awful thing on snow there ever was this Rover 90. And he come back, and we had a grey A35 van. That's what I had, wasn't it, when we first started karting. And he jumped in A35 van and it just flew up. And it wasn't brand new, it was second hand. He bought it second hand, and it were a lot of money for him them days. I think it was 1150 quid with this Rover 90 second hand. And it were a lot of money, was that.
But don't take it out in snow.
No, it was useless. Because he'd had two or three A55s. Before that, he'd had two anyways I know of, and they used to cost about 500 to £525 a year. And he had two or else three of them, and he traded them in every year, and he could trade them in for 50 quid. Get a brand new one for an extra 50 quid. Which, you wouldn't be able to do out like that today, would you?
And can you just explain, for the purpose of the tape, as they say, what a boskinning is and what a weather is? Because you mentioned both of those.
All right, okay. Well, a boskin is the how your shipment's divided up. When they were old, they were wooden, made out of wood, into the floor and maybe up into the top and about, I don't know, yard of... 4 foot high, and then there was a piece of metal that a round out rung on. And now a round out's a bit different. It was a big ring, and then a joint that turned round so it wouldn't tighten the thing up, and then a little ring that you put your cow band through that tied your cow up. And the boskin is what the round out's tied to. Has that explained it?
No, that's fine. And a wether.
A wether? Well, he's a castrated tuck lamb.
And a hog.
Well, a hog's when it gets to 9 month old, they start and call them hogs. Once you get your lambs are lambs from sort of the day of the born to the turn of the year when they're 9 or 10 month old. Once they get to January, they call them hogs. Like today, we are selling what we call spring lambs, and as soon as they get past January, they'll be down as hogs. So they're sort of 9 month old is a hog until it's a shearling, and then until it's a year old, then it's called a shearling.
And with Joan coming from away, have you picked up any phrases from her, or is it one-way traffic that she's picked up from Lancashire?
I mean, there's odd phrases that her dad used to say, like, and that she keeps coming up with, like, you know. And,
can you think of any or not?
Well, there's one he used to say, something about him being busy. Can't you say I'm busy? And what are you doing? I'm building a wigwam for ducks to peek on.
He'd never give us a straight answer.
It's funny because things like that have cropped up a few times. Of this, and the phrases differ, but it's basically sort of stop asking questions,
right? Well, well, yeah, that's about it. Yeah,
We also, when we were kids, if we hurt ourselves, you know, she used to say, "Never mind, they'll do after it." Cause
that'd
be before.
Yeah, and like you say, I suppose it's difficult for you to think of phrases that are sort of, it's probably for us to judge phrases that are unique to this area, isn't it? But, yeah, sort of local sayings that might not be universal in other areas of the country. I mean, I don't really think of any of those, but like you say, it's difficult for you because you've always used them.
Yeah, well, I mean, one that would, I mean, my mother's sister's husband was my Uncle Fred, and he used to come on a lot on here. He worked on the council, and if he worked any overtime on the council, like, he had to pay a lot of tax on it, so he liked to come on here, do a bit of airtime, a bit of walling, because he was a good hand at walling, and like, my dad would pay him cash, and so that was grand, because he hadn't tax to pay on that, and all this, that, and other. You maybe shouldn't put that in there.
It's probably after, I think there'll be a limit on...
Yeah. and you saw us be on about a ligging off cow. You say, well, it is a laying off cow. It's laying off because it's dry and it's making ready for having its next calf. And they always used to call it a ligging off cow. And that's what, and I mean, a lot of people call them that anyway.
I've not heard that one, actually. No, I've not heard that.
Right, yeah.
You want to go through the pictures?
I think so. Yeah. So this is the
to see if there are the bit. Different names. Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yes. So that's the first one.
Well, that's a hedgehog.
Yeah.
Is there any other
name?
Is there any
used?
All right. And that's a Danny long legs.
Yeah.
Is it a crystallix? Crystallis?
What you're meaning is something that a butterfly comes out of.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, it isn't, but...
No, it's... So we're not really allowed to say what we'd call it, but it's fair enough. If there's no specific term you'd use for it.
They give me the clue.
Right, okay. No, I wouldn't know what that is.
No, right. I mean, that's we'd call that an earwig.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
But I didn't know whether there's another...
Right, okay.
Like I say, this isn't to test, you know, whether you...
No.
It's more sort of if you've got...
It's what a local
term.
Word
yeah,
is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's sticky back.
That's another one. I haven't heard that name.
Sticky back. Sticks to you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Sticky back, what do you call it?
We'd call that, or I'd call that goosegrass.
Sticky back.
Yeah.
Sticky back.
Yeah.
I've not heard.
My aunt used to call it cleavers as well, mm-hmm. So I'd call it. Right, this is what they're wanting to.
Well, that's a chrysalis, or what? Isn't it?
It's water. It's a...
Oh, it's water.
It's a droplet.
Well, if it's water, I'd call it a globule.
Globule. They're saying a dewdrop.
Yes, it's for dew, I think that's what they're getting at there.
I didn't know what it was. No. I looked at it.
Yeah. We're not supposed to prompt. That's
a bag of sweets.
Is there any? Would you? And as kids, would you call them sweets, or would you?
You might call them toffees. I mean, they're not, but it's, you know, when there's mixtures like that, some of them would be called dolly mixtures and different sort of things.
I've heard somebody said, you know, one of these things, and I can't remember this northeast. He said spice, which was more sort of Richmondy.
Right,
okay.
Northeast, you know,
corn
spice,
but I've never heard of that. No, it's that one,
yeah.
Well, it's a bone of some sort. I mean, it's a bread bun. I mean, it has a bit of, has it flour on top of it, or... If it'd be nice in sugar, you'd have said it were an ice bun, but it isn't an ice bun. I just think it's a bun.
Some people call them baps or whatever. It's just a different...
Yeah, well, you say, Our Rogers down south, Leicestershire, yeah. they call a sandwich a bap.
Yes.
And we call it a sandwich.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, there's butty probably in South Yorkshire's butty probably, yeah. Isn't it? In
there? Mm. Mm. I think there is more people calling a sandwich a bap,
yes,
now than there's ever been. Mm. Well, is it a rock cake? A rock bun?
Yeah. Your wife's right.
What is it?
Scone, you've got on the thing.
Well, it's not. It's
a scone, isn't it?
It's
a scone. It is.
No, because it don't look like the ones I make. That's why it doesn't look.
But again, it's. I suppose it's down to.
It's a rock bun. Yes. Is that cream?
Scone, or.
I think it is. They've covered up the writing deliberately.
Okay.
So that, to draw. They want to know how many are in there, in the picture.
Wanted to what?
How many of these there are.
Well, there's three.
Yeah, quite. Right, and then, who's that? Yeah. They have different names in different places.
Well, they're spring onions, aren't
yeah.
they?
Yeah, yeah. My mum would call them scallions sometimes. Yeah.
No, what there is another word for them. What word is there for them?
Spring onions.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one I know.
Okay. There's another word for them, though.
That's a method of transport rather than...
Piggyback.
Yeah.
any other words as kids that you'd use? I mean, we used to say piggyback, but
no, I don't think so.
And then it's
that's a seesaw.
Yeah, that's what we'd have called it. And then, yes, complete this by selecting the words you'd use in conversation.
Yeah. So if you were sat with your mates.
He asked me to fix it, and
shoes.
Or whatever you use, you know, doesn't have to be there.
No, I don't know what I'd put in there. Mm.
I said.
Yeah, most probably I'd say.
Yeah.
No way, do it yourself.
Yeah.
I'm not very good with words.
Well, no, it's not, and it's more about, you know, if you were sat with your friends and you were chatting away normally. I mean, this is a bit sort of artificial, isn't it? It just feels a bit, but it's sort of whether you would use a different, you know.
So the food was something tasty.
I'd most probably put jolly.
Jolly tasty.
Mm.
Mm. Lovely, thank you. There's some others here. Do you normally go through those others or not?
I've not done that. I haven't seen those actually.
Have we got time? Are you all right?
Yeah, how are you doing?
Are you all right for time?
Yeah.
Are you okay for time?
Well, these are question prompts, they call them. So what do you call a room in a house for storing food?
Pantry.
Pantry or larger.
If you haven't eaten any food for a long time, you're bound to feel...
starving.
What words do you use for something to eat?
Something?
To eat.
Grub.
A bit of prompting going on here.
My dad would say grub up sometimes. Yeah,
yes.
Brought up in South Yorkshire.
Well, we say that, grub up.
What do you call a coffee you might get from a cafe with lots of milk in it?
A milk coffee? It's not... something I order much.
Exactly.
Is it in coffee? Because I'm not a coffee person.
No.
Yeah.
John's a coffee. She's a coffee person. I am.
Yeah. We raised our eyes and we heard it. What's the dairy product that you spread on toast and sandwiches?
Butter. Well, it can be out, can't it?
I think it's part, it might be a different word, you know, sort of word that you have, but also I suppose it's pronunciation as well. Yeah. It's like scone and scone, isn't it?
It is.
And yeah, butter,
butter and yeah.
Yeah.
Which word or phrase would you use to indicate a temporary break in a game when points cannot be scored?
When points are...
cannot be scored. I guess the game is temporarily paused. Sorry, I shouldn't be saying
no,
that.
No, it's fine. No, it's
no,
fine.
No, that's what it is.
It's difficult to know what they're getting
at. Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're playing dominoes and somebody wasn't getting on with you, you'd tell them to get on with it, wouldn't you? I don't know what you'd call it.
I just remember at school playing netball and we'd have a... 10 minutes when we weren't playing netball in the middle.
Well, you'd have
what
a
would we call that?
Well, you'd call it a break, wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. They've given you the word in the question.
Yeah, yeah.
Depends what sport. Yeah, depends what sport you're playing, doesn't it? Really,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
If you fall over in the playground, your knee might be.
Your knee
might be.
Grazed.
Yeah, that's what I think. Yeah. Mm. If you got covered in dirt at the playground, when you get home, you might need to get in the...
bath.
That's what they say. Again, it might be this northern and southern pronunciation. When children are very excited, you might say they are full of...
joys of spring.
At the end of a long and tiring day, you'd say you were absolutely...
Oh. Well, I could tell you. I could tell you.
We can always edit it.
I'm not going to say it, though.
Let yourself go, Frank. Or you... Yeah. I don't want to prompt you, but there are sort of...
I've heard you say jiggered.
Yeah,
sort of jiggered is a phrase that people do use, isn't it?
Well, you might say I'm jiggered, but you might say, well, you might as well say what you really mean.
Which word would you use to mean not attending school?
Well, it says absence is skived off.
I think they were looking for the latter. sometimes when children are being very naughty, their parents tell them that someone will come and take them away. What do you call this mysterious person?
Bogeyman.
Right, yeah. You grow crops and raise animals on a...
well, small holding.
When you walk in the countryside after heavy rain, your shoes will get covered in
mud.
When driving in icy or wet weather, you must take care because the roads are
slippy.
Especially in Austin.
An Austin over 90. Yeah. Were they those cars?
Heavy cars, they rock. BMWs work much better than a Rover 90.
Yeah.
We had a BMW. You couldn't get out of village if it was snowing, could you, John?
Yeah.
It was useless. Yeah.
Which word do you use as a term of endearment, even with strangers?
Say it again.
Which word do you use as a term of endearment, even with strangers?
No.
You would?
I would say love. Love,
yeah.
Yeah.
Which word would you use to refer to someone as very attractive?
Well, if it was a girl, you'd say she's a bonny lass.
What is your word for spreading rumours?
Telling tales? Telltale.
Telltale. A picture not hanging straight is hanging...
Lobsided, lobcodded.
I say
lobcodded.
Lobcodded.
Well, we'd use that one. Lobcodded. Occasionally, yeah. Anyway. Depend who we're here.
Well, a lot of these do, don't they? Yeah. Depends what sort of group of people you're with. What words you use.
Right? Yeah. What do you call a very small piece of wood that has got into your finger?
Splinter. Mm.
What do you call a person who mends shoes and boots?
Because my granddad was one.
Cobbler.
I would.
Yeah.
Do you have any other words you'd like to tell us about? That's it.
We know he knows plenty.
It's bringing them to mind at the time. Isn't
it? Yeah.
But it's also something that, you know, us listening to you, we can pick up on things that, you know, are obviously from this area, but you won't necessarily. You know, if it's how you've always spoken, it's difficult sometimes that it's difficult for you.
Well,
to
you
say,
don't know you're doing it,
no,
do you?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, like it's you know.
Yeah. Is there anything else?
Because I mean, we sometimes say like, if you've said the wrong thing at the wrong place, you said you should have put your brain into gear before you opened your mouth, like, and it. But once you've opened your mouth, you can't take it back,
yes.
Can you?
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that, Frank. I really appreciate giving up your time to do this, and it's been absolutely brilliant. You've come up with some really good stories there, and it's always, these things are always better if you sort of flow freely, which you have done really well, and rather than say that it being too much of an interview, so I really appreciate your time. And thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.